Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who has a vast collection of vintage DC and Marvel comic books, and ironically lives in Minnesota, where his favorite NBA team, the LA Lakers, originated, Dave Denniston.
Welcome back, my friends, to another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping doctors like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Now, I know a lot of us, we've talked a lot of in this podcast about building your assets, getting rid of debt, and hopefully you get to be at a good point where you've built up all these assets and you have this first world problem of needing to be able to protect them. You spend all this time and energy and effort trying to do that. Well, I have here with us a guest that is going to speak us through and give us some really good knowledge bombs on how to protect our assets. This gentleman has been named to all kinds of different lists, Lawyers of Distinctions list, Super Lawyers Rising Stars list. He's been on a number of different podcasts, including The White Coat Investor. So hopefully we'll bring something new here to the show. Please help me welcome Brian Bradley. Welcome, Brian, to the show.
Hey, thanks, Dave, for having me on and putting this podcast together. This really is a big topic, especially for the physicians and those doctors who are also investing on the side. And, you know, I really like your intro and how you want to, you know, see them destroy their debt and live liberated. And, you know, my job and what I want to do is make sure it's protected and stays that way.
Absolutely. No, I think that's the game. You know, you work so hard and especially nowadays with as much debt as people have had, and all of a sudden you have assets, the last thing you want to do is lose them.
Exactly. It kind of goes to the saying, you know, it's not a matter of what you have, but what you keep.
Yes. Yes, sir. That's a good one. I love that one. Well, tell me a little bit, Brian, before we get into all this awesome content, tell us a little bit about you. What's your background? Where are you from? How did you get to doing what you're doing now?
Yeah, no problem. So kind of the man behind the firm is I grew up in Lake Tahoe in the mountains, skier, snowboarder, you know, big outdoors guy. Went to college, Arizona State for baseball, tore up my arm 3 times and had to refigure my life out. And, you know, couldn't really, had no direction. I, you know, smart guy, ended up doing, you know, studying philosophy and psychology. And decided I wanted to give law school a try. So I went to a small school actually in California, Southern California Institute of Law, that most people never would hear of, because I just didn't want to come out of school with a lot of debt, not knowing a direction in life and not being able to pay that debt down. So I just made a calculated decision and saying, I'm going to go to a small school, learn the same stuff, come out debt free. And that way I can do what I want to do in my life and not be pigeonholed by a bunch of debt. Came out of law school in 2008, right when the economy just completely tanked. And I was being hired by the Santa Barbara District Attorney's Office, but then that offer got rescinded just because, you know, the whole state of California was on a hiring freeze. Mm-hmm. So I had to refigure my life out and just keep pivoting. And so ended up getting into a small firm, litigation firm. And they just threw me into the fire, which is what I wanted. And so I had about 150 open cases at a time. And I was just going through, you know, trial and court. And ended up building a name for myself. The economy trickled into private practice, got let go because I wasn't a family member. It was a family-owned firm. And the owner pulled me aside and was like, hey, man, you got the gift. Just go out on your own and don't be afraid to stick your neck out. And that's what I did. But with the economy how it was, the only way I was able to continue going was just to represent people for free because no one had money. So I went to different state agencies. I was like, listen, I know you got clients who need help. They're indigent clients. No one has money. You can't even afford to pay me. You just cover the court cost. I'll go in and represent them for free because I just need to keep, you know, working. I'm not going to just start working at Starbucks and quit practicing law. And so I did that for 3 years. And just got more trial and litigation work than probably most people in 25 years of litigation practice got. And it helped propel me into seeing all the problems that I saw developing in law. Just people being sued from one reason or the other, whether it was credible or not. And their lives just turned completely upside down. And I wanted to help people get ahead of this. And I got sick of this sue happy nirvana legal system that we live in. And this hits home for me because my wife works in the medical field as a hospitalist. And most of my friends and family all work in the medical field. And so I hear the griping that they talk about and their major concern of, you know, oh my gosh, I'm afraid of being sued within the next 10 years and chasing me out of practicing medicine. And so I'm investing on the side to have a backup, you know, retirement career. And this is the constant talk that we have and with my other doctor clients. And it always comes down to the liability for, you know, you in the medical field goes beyond just the profession. You know, there's always a business side that goes beyond just malpractice. There's billing issues, payroll violations, sexual harassment claims, you know, and others that are internal that aren't even covered by your medical malpractice. And then you add on the other external issues, like if you own the property that you're practicing out of, or if you're investing on the side, which you focus on a lot here. And then when it comes down to it, you know, the unfortunate thing is that medical malpractice litigation alone is a multi-billion with a B dollar industry. It's pretty scary. You know, it's its own business. And then the AMA came out with statistics showing that 1 out of 3 doctors, so 34% of you, have already been sued. And then the longer you practice, that percent goes to 55% that have been sued before the age of 55. And then 48% of those doctors were named personally. And then out of all of this, 89% of these claims are generally filed frivolously just to try to get a payday. But the doctors have to fight these anyways. They can't just walk away from them. And it completely turns their lives upside down. And doctors are perceived to be deep pockets, even if you're not. Whether you're just coming out of residency and can't rub $2 together, just by having that credential, you're perceived to be deep pockets. And so what I do is advanced planning, while keeping in mind the overall goal of asset protection really is lifestyle preservation. You know, we want to have you have a stress-free life and knowing that you have something that will protect you and that's strong should something go wrong. You already have the team and the system and the structure already in place.
So one of my things I was wondering as I think about whether a doctor hangs a shingle out or in your case, you were just getting started. As you talked about your past, how did you make it? Because I imagine you have student debt or you had student debt from coming out of law school and you were working a lot of pro bono cases. How did you make it just day to day?
So coming out of law school, I had no debt because I worked during the day, went to school at night, and I made sure that I was able to cover my expenses. And that's why I chose that specific school was I didn't want to go and have to pay $100,000, $200,000 of student loans. So I just looked at what's the best school that I can go to that's not going to mass amount a lot of debt and give the same education. And then I wanted to do a night program so I can work during the day. And so I worked at the Santa Barbara DA's office for 3 years as an intern, learning how to practice law, thinking I was just going to step and fill in the role, but then the economy went out of whack. And so what I ended up having to do was just bootstrap experience plus find ways to pay my bills and just realize eventually it's all going to work out, you know, but it was just the hunger and drive in me was I have to do these steps to get to my accomplished goal. So I can either walk away from my goal and quit, or I can just improvise, modify, adapt, and overcome and find a way through it. And eventually it will pay off in the long run.
Nice. I love it. So as we look at asset protection strategies, certainly there's a lot of things we could cover, and we'll just try the next 20 minutes or so to cover whatever we can. If we think about some of the top ways, Brian, you know, initially, certainly where people normally save are in their retirement plans, you know, is a very typical first place. Even many residents save a little bit there. And then as physicians get going, they might get some money from employers that are going in retirement plans. Tell us a little bit about, you know, for someone that's just getting started, what kind of asset protections do they have or do they not have that they should be thinking about?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the first place is always pick up your exemptions, state and federal exemptions. For example, some states have good homestead exemptions like Florida and Texas. So if you own your property, pick, you know, you don't need to do anything about that. You already have the homestead protection. And then, I wouldn't say just you start rubbing money together. Don't just go out frivolously spend it. You know, like start paying down your debt. Do something wise so you have more money that you're making later on to invest. But the next thing that I would do is start, like you said, fund your 401k and your Roth IRAs. You know, the good thing about 401ks is, they're government ERISA plans, so they're already protected and exempt. So an exemption is you don't need to really do anything to protect it on top of it. It's already exempted from an attack. That's the great thing about 401ks is you can max those out. The only issue that comes down with your 401ks is when you start withdrawing the funds. You know, if you start withdrawing those funds early and you have a creditor lien against you, then we can have to do some advanced planning potentially on that. But most don't realize that your Roth IRAs that you create separate, through like TD Ameritrade or Vanguard or whatever, are only limited protection. And so it's only partially protected from bankruptcy. So you do have to take some steps to potentially protect that. But it's a state-by-state determination. Some states protect them strong, some states different. It just depends on the state.
And how would someone find that out?
I would just go on, talk to either a lawyer who's just, asset protection specialist, and then they'll look up your state laws and codes and let you know, or just contact one in your state and just, and ask, or you can just, I would jump online just to get some quick information and say, I live in, Nebraska, is my Roth IRA in an exempt status or not? And you should start finding some basic information on there. And then if you really wanted to start protecting your assets, then you talk to a lawyer about that.
So sometimes not all retirement accounts are treated equally is what
correct. And it's going to be a state by state determination. Different states will treat IRA exemptions differently. Same thing with life insurance, so some have significant protection, others not as much, and some have none at all.
Off the states that you're specialized in, can you think off the top of your head, just to give us a few examples? Like obviously Oregon, you're in Oregon. How does Oregon treat?
Horrible. I live in, my licenses are all, West Coast, California, Oregon, Washington, and then Michigan, all horrible protection states. So I wouldn't even think that, don't even think you're going to have anything covered unless it's a government ERISA account. So if you're in California, I would definitely look to higher levels of asset protection, like asset protection trust that we'll talk about later on. But most states on the coast, East Coast, West Coast, horrible. South, Florida, Texas, they're going to be stronger. Delaware, Wyoming, going to be strong. The rest of them is just going to be 50-50.
And of course, everyone should just take this as general knowledge, make sure to check out your specific state and situation from what Brian is telling us here. So that definitely helps us with retirement accounts. What about a lot of people, Brian, will go and get like a revocable trust? Maybe they have some assets now that are not in retirement plans at all. It's just in their names. Maybe it's in a revocable trust or an irrevocable trust. And it might even be helpful for folks that are listening to this and say, I have no idea what you just said. What is irrevocable? What is revocable? Money that's not, maybe you want to walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. So the first thing is a major confusion of, okay, I have a revocable living trust, which is, basically a directive of when you die, who's going to take your property. That's what it does. And they were set up for tax, avoiding probate, the courts, and taxes. There's no protection whatsoever that a revocable living trust offers because they're not designed to. The only thing they were created for and is to dictate who gets what when you die and then to decrease your taxable estate. But both of those really don't apply in modern day society because the death tax amount was increased substantially. So if you're married, you're basically, unless you have over $22.1 million of a taxable estate, that's not going to matter for you. And then probate, there's no issue here because you have your revocable living trust directing who you want your beneficiaries to be. So that's not a strategy to build your liability protection around, but you need to have one. It works in tandem with asset protection because you need to direct who's going to get what when you die. But the difference between revocable and irrevocable is simply a revocable trust I maintain control over and I can change at will. The issue with that is if I'm being sued, a judge is going to say, I want that asset back. It's, you're in control of it, transfer it back so that creditor can get access to it. An irrevocable trust, you start getting into what's called like an asset protection trust. It means I can't easily go and change it. And the issue with this is the difference of, well, I'll just break this topic down. It's called jurisdiction. And what you don't want is a court and a judge to be able to say, bring that asset back. But only 17 states in the U.S. actually have some sort of what's called asset protection legislation, self-settled spendthrift trust, which are what we're talking about. If you don't live in one of those states, like let's say you're a California resident, and you go get a Nevada asset protection trust, an irrevocable grantor, you know, asset protection trust in Nevada. There's case law in Kilker versus Stillman 2012 that came out and said, we don't care that you have a Nevada asset protection trust because you're a California resident. You're not a resident of Nevada. Those statutes will only apply to those states' residents that live there. So you're not going to get the benefit of it. And so what you're seeing is, you know, across the state plane is, if you're not a resident of those states, the courts are now disregarding those choice of law and clauses, and they're piercing those domestic asset protection trusts and giving access to the what's in there to the creditors. And so the domestic asset protection trust is strong, is really good if you're a resident of those states that have them, one of those 17 states. And even those are getting weakened now. What you really want, if you really were concerned about asset protection, is what's called statutory non-recognition. And so when you're creating asset protection trusts, you have two options. You can either go domestically here in the US or you go offshore. The offshore component came first. It was created in the 1980s in the Cook Islands, and it's still the gold standard. You know, for over 40 years, they're still used globally and they're virtually impossible to be pierced. Domestically, we came next about 10 years later, and we have half the amount of case law and they're still starting to be pierced. I prefer the power of going offshore if and when it's needed, especially for highly visible or high risk clients like doctors who are also investing because their liability is a lot higher. They make lawsuits go away very fast. They get resolved very quick, even against super creditors like the IRS and SEC. And that's because of what I said, the power of statutory non-recognition. What this means is that a U.S. judgment is completely worthless in the Cook Islands. They're just going to say, thanks, we see that, but this is the Cook Islands. We don't recognize that statute, you know, your claim or your lawsuit or judgment, go pound sand. We just don't care. You know, what you have to do is sue us, you know, your the client here in the Cook Islands, start your case all over from scratch. Prove your case beyond the murder, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt, the murder standard. You'd have to fly in a judge from New Zealand, front all the court costs. And if you lose, oh, hey, you also pay. And so when you're trying to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt, you're most likely going to lose. And you only have 1 year as a statute of limitations to file in the Cook Islands. So it's a very, very, very strong trust.
It sounds great. And there's two questions that enter my mind as I hear this. Number one, I have to imagine that in order to have this make sense, you know, you really need to have a certain net worth, right? Because I'm sure there's a lot of hassle and cost involved with doing this.
Yeah. And so exactly.
At what point should someone be considering something like this?
Yeah, so the purely foreign option, I only recommend to people if your hair's already on fire, you're staring down the barrel of a gun, you know, a lot big lawsuit right away. And it's not needed for everybody. The purely foreign option, I generally find to be overkill. Not everybody's going to need it. The asset protection trust of purely foreign, you know, Cook Islands trust or what, you know, the hybrid bridge trust, generally have that conversation at $1 million net worth. Or depending on the client's area of medical practice and where the risk is, how much the risk is compared to the other assets that they have.
Or would we say $1 million outside of ERISA plans? Would that be fair?
Yeah, of what of assets that are not protected. Got exactly. It. And so we already talked about why the domestic plans fail and their weakness and the strength of the foreign. But part of the negative side of a purely foreign trust is they're expensive. You know, the maintenance is going to be around $5,000 to $10,000 annually. And then you have a lot of IRS compliance and disclosures that you have to use all the time. So if you don't have to go purely foreign, you shouldn't need to go there. And so there is a hybrid, which is classified both domestically and foreign, and it's called a bridge trust. And so I would say unless you need to go foreign, you don't pick domestic, you don't pick offshore, you combine the two and have the best of both worlds. The bridge trust was created over 30 years ago. And the word bridge is just used to demonstrate how you're using a foreign trust and then connecting the two countries together with a bridge. And then you just cross that bridge to the safety of the Cook Islands if you ever need it when you're under attack. If you're not under attack, the trust stays here domestically and you don't have to pay the extra maintenance costs. Instead of spending $5,000 to $10,000 annually, it's only about $2,100 annual maintenance fees. You don't have to worry about the IRS disclosures because it's a domestic trust. So you're going to get the St. Germain's protection and some anonymity. If you ever had to trigger the bridge and cross the bridge, then obviously it's purely foreign. And then you would have to pay the extra cost while your assets are overseas and do the IRS compliance. And then when the lawsuit goes away, it transitions back to a domestic trust. And so the way this kind of works is, for the CPAs and lawyer listeners or your doctors who just really want to kind of geek out on some of the nuts and bolts, the bridge trust, like any asset protection trust, is an irrevocable tax neutral grantor trust. And why you want the trust to be irrevocable, like we discussed earlier, is that if you're ever challenged and in front of a judge and that judge says, hey, I see you have assets, we think you have control over those assets and we want to collect on them, bring them back. At that point, when the trust is triggered, you can't do that. So you can't be held in civil contempt by the judge until you bring the assets back. And this has been shown through case law. There's the U.S. versus Grant case, U.S. versus Slow case, the famous Anderson case. And then like all asset protection trusts, it's a self-settled spendthrift trust. So it's created by you, for you, as your own beneficiary. And the way that it's classified domestic, even though you have this foreign component, is because the trust is written in compliance with the USC section 7701, which is a court test and the control test. And so how the trust becomes foreign is you drop those measures if you're ever under attack, and we think it's in the best interest of the client to do it. So you're no longer in compliance with the court test. You're no longer in compliance with the control test. That then transitions the trust to being purely foreign.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting. Well, a lot of stuff to chew on there and probably re-listen to for those of us that aren't in this. The other thing I guess I would generally think of, the second part of my question as I hear you talk, when I think of irrevocable trusts, they're called irrevocable for a reason, right? You can't revoke them. In this
very, part. Very hard. There's ways to do it domestically, but then it just weakens the protection of the trust because then you can be ordered to do it. And so that's
So my question around that is, someone puts a bunch of money in this kind of trust. Normally with irrevocable trust, like one of my relatives has one, there's certain restrictions on what she can do with that money. That another family member is kind of overseeing as the trustee, where she can only get, you know, XYZ percent of the trust per year. How hard or easy is it to get your hands on money from these things once it's been put in there?
It depends on what type of trust you're using and if it's domestic or if it's, you know, the bridge trust or foreign. It should be fairly easy. I don't know how that trust was drafted and why there were certain limitations put in there. Just because you have a trustee doesn't mean you can't get access to your funds. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to read through that trust and see why certain parameters were put in there for what reason. But generally, the access to your funds is not going to hinder your ability to live or invest or pay your bills or do anything that you would want. The way that it generally works is you have, let's say, your real estate. You put your real estate into an LLC. You put that LLC into an asset management limited partnership. The trust owns the limited partnership. And so you still have full maintenance and control to invest however you want, and you still have access to the funds fully, and there should never be a hindrance of your ability to get access to the funds unless it was set up specifically for a reason to do that.
Got it. Just want to throw that out there. So thank you so much for that. Now, I know one of the things that we were talking before we got going was inheritance and divorce and things like that that can happen in life. Any just general thoughts or strategies on what people can be doing there, Brian?
Yeah. So for inheritance, I would say, even if you're going to go and get an asset protection trust, whether it's domestic or foreign or the hybrid bridge trust, you know, and the bridge trust is going to be $30,000 to set up. Same, like foreign trust will be a little bit more. Domestic trust will generally be around $12,000 to $17,000. So those are the cost of it. You're still going to need your revocable living trust. So don't think you don't need that, because you still want to have the directives of who gets what. So you still get a revocable living trust. Just understand the limitations of it. Just because you put your assets into a revocable living trust, there's zero protection that's offered, because there isn't any. They're not designed for it. They can't. A court will just cut through that like a hot knife through butter. The next thing to understand, you know, like with divorce, because I get this question a lot, you know, you have to look at the situation through fraudulent conveyance. So it comes down to, are we dealing with separate assets or community assets? You know, like what's the characteristic of that assets? The reality is that a good portion of the assets acquired during a marriage are going to be deemed community assets purchased with community funds. Mm-hmm. So in divorces, you can't take all the assets and just place them in an asset protection trust to try to, you know, take them away from one spouse who's in trying to shield them away from that other spouse. Like, you can't convert a client's community assets into separate assets without a judge saying that's okay or in an agreement between you. But you still can do some planning, like especially against creditor planning while you're going through your divorce. First, you know, you can plan individually, but only with the separate assets, with a, you know, a clear agreement from both spouses to characterize the assets, how they need to be characterized, and possibly sign a postnuptial agreement. Second, they can continue with the planning, but with both spouses as part of the planning, and then clarifying within that plan itself the character of the property. Or third, you just do the planning separately, but then you specifically exempt the protection of the plan from the divorce proceeding itself. And so you let the judge say, hey, we created this asset protection planning. We're exempting all the protection of this for this divorce proceeding so that we can characterize and divide up the assets.
Okay. Interesting. I had heard that, and this, I'm sure this is dependent state to state, that when folks inherit money, that if they get it, it goes into their name.
Are you there?
I'm still here. Can you hear me okay? Oh, Brian? So one thing I had heard, Brian, that had been advised to me in the past was when you inherit money, and I'm sure this depends state to state. So let's say I inherit money and we put it in an account for David Denniston, and we never put that money into my wife's name. Is something like that a strategy that can help people?
Yeah, I mean, just generally, inheritance itself is separate property. So as you're inheriting something, it's not going to automatically be recharacterized as a community asset, as long as you don't commingle it. You know, if you were to then take that asset, you know, start using it to pay off, for example, your wife's or your husband's student loan debt, mm-hmm. all of a sudden, you just now created a potential argument that those assets now are being commingled for the benefit of the community. So you just want to keep them separate.
So even if it was a let's say it was $1,000, and you moved $1,000 of that inheritance money to your joint account.
You just commingled that because you put it into your joint account. You should keep it in a separate individual account that's not connected to you or your spouse.
Got it. So that's definitely some for folks to think about. Well, Brian, I'm sure there's a lot we could dig into here, but there's only so much time in the day-to-day. Do you have just any final thoughts on what doctors should be thinking about or doing that we haven't addressed already?
Yeah, I think, you know, one is just plan proactively. You know, even if medical malpractice may not be your biggest issue, think about all the other areas of your life that you have liability in. You're going to be presumed deep pockets. So I'd rather pay 5 cents on the dollar now than 75 cents on the dollar later on when I'm being sued. And so just proactively plan and set up insulation and protection from frivolous suits, you know, by formulating and implementing a protection plan. You know, this helps deter litigation before it gets started. It places you in a position of strength to settle cases literally for pennies on the dollar, because if they realize, oh, hey, there's a foreign asset protection trust, I get nothing. You know, okay, we'll take that penny on the dollar. And this isn't, like I said, just for medical malpractice, but all the other areas of your business and investment life. We're trying to protect the whole family, the whole entity.
Awesome. Awesome. And let's see, where can people find you if they have questions, they want to reach out? I know that you consult in a number of different states. So you're not just limited to Oregon or California or Washington. Where can people find you if they have more questions?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. So we represent clients nationwide. They can jump on my website, www.btblegal.com. I have lots of information on there and brochures and pamphlets and videos. A really big frequently asked question section. And they can always email me at my email, Brian, B-R-I-A-N at btblegal.com. And we do free consultations. Like, I'd rather just have people have access to the information and ask their questions and make educated decisions versus being too afraid to call because they don't want to pay a consultation fee. Get an asset and risk profile. Like, let's go through your life. Let's see what a good plan is. And then take that information and think about it and go talk to other firms. But just get the access to educate yourself and the information.
I love it. That's great. All right, Brian. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and definitely reach out to Brian, everybody. If you have questions, check out his website. And that will wrap up the episode for today. Thank you again so much for joining me in another episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Remember, my friends, remember to slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle.